to start the show because I like to do that at the beginning.
I think that's a good place to do it.
Sometimes it happens in the middle.
That's insane.
Well, you know, we try to. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Our guest this week is sitcom writer and producer Dan O'Shannon.
Yay!
Dan has written and produced for Cheers, Frasier, Modern Family, The New Odd Couple.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, other things, right?
I'm sure. Tons of all kinds of crap. Stuff,
yeah. Oh, they're old, so long. We'll hear more from Dan in a moment, but first a message from our corporate overlords. Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACSDigital.tv. I'm Denzel Myers. Our guest today is television comedy writer, producer Dan O'Shannon. Hello.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for doing this when you don't really know me or know anything about me or the show.
I trust you. You have a nice, open, honest face that people seem to trust. I'm good.
Okay. And you got that from radio.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. The first thing I want to ask about is Ray Ellis and the Spider-Man.
Oh, all right.
Spider-Man cartoon music, because we're kind of the same age.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, I listen to that stuff. I watch those things after school every day. And
No one's ever asked me about that before.
I recently went on to say, where the hell is that music? And I found it. And it's like an hour, a couple hours. I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
How did you get involved? What do you know about this guy?
Okay, well, just for people listening who don't know what this is about, back in the late 60s, there was an animated TV series, you know, Spider-Man. Everyone remembers the theme song, Spider-Man does whatever a spider can, etc. And one of the great things about it, one of the many great things about it, and, you know, I was at an age where I saw it mostly after school, so I saw it like 5 days a week, and is that it had great incidental music. The music was really kind of terrific jazz, kind of swingy things, and these themes that would come up in needle drop after needle drop. And they needed great music because it was very limited animation, and they had to pad out their stories with endless shots of Spider-Man swinging across a city. Which they used and used and used. So they needed at least something interesting underneath it. And people of my generation tend to, the ones that watched that, really kind of without realizing it, that music sunk into their heads and became something that you know, after the digital revolution when everything seemed to come out, all the incidental music to this and that, and all the pieces of all the stuff we grew up watching came out and was available, people started asking, where's the music for this? Where's the background music?
So and I'm not the first one.
Oh, no. If you've gone online to find, I'm sure you've seen other people looking for it.
Yeah.
And there are bands that actually play the music. They've figured out how to score the music and they play it. And so what I did was when, because they used many of these pieces, these background pieces over and over again in different episodes. When the series came out on DVD, I went through episode by episode and pulled out all the music. And what I did was by stitching together different versions that were in different episodes so that I could cut around the dialogue, I had as many dialogue-free pieces as I could get. You know, because in one, you know, with one version of the song, Spider-Man talks halfway through, right. And in another version of the song, there's some dialogue at the beginning, but the end is clean. So by splicing together, you have an approximate version of what the thing sounded like with no dialogue.
Rhinoceros gets in the way, Dr. Octopus gets in
the way.
Well,
yeah, exactly. You know, oh, yeah, guys, yeah. And there's a couple sound effects here and there I sort of couldn't avoid, but I went through and did them all as best I could, considering that I'm not like a technician or anything. And other people have then gone since and maybe cleaned up a couple of mine and added new ones of their own that I wasn't able to figure out.
So one of these things on YouTube is your edit?
Yeah, one of these things on YouTube, one of the ones on YouTube is a collection of my stuff.
Okay, I couldn't tell that from looking.
Yeah, and then
did you publish under a false name?
Well,
pseudonym?
I didn't publish, no, someone else, because I was putting it out as a CD and I would be giving it to people and people would ask for it and I'd send it out. And I also have a website called oshannonland.com. And if you go to oshannonland.com, you'll see two things. One is that I haven't put a thing up in 2 years. And two is that you can click on the Spider-Man music page and you can listen to a bunch of these things I put together if you're so inclined. But people have put them on YouTube and then put their own versions on YouTube. So it's all out there somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I've been listening to it. Like I said, somebody's got an hour's worth or an hour and 15 minutes on YouTube.
Yeah.
And so I just...
A lot of those cuts are mine. Yeah. And people add their own versions of cuts and that sort of thing. But it started. But I will say that I did start it.
So just for those people that care about this kind of crap, the original series started in 1967,
I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, and ran for 2 or 3 years
three seasons, and then just endless syndication.
And endless. That's why I saw it in Philadelphia,
Cleveland here. Yeah.
You know, Channel 17 or Channel 29,
43
or one
for
of those
me.
Kind of things. And now Ray Ellis has died, right? He's not alive anymore.
I think he did pass away a couple years ago.
Yeah, but okay, if you're going to...
And for whatever reason, those master tapes have not popped up anywhere.
Well,
so it'd be nice one day if it does.
Because I read about him, because I didn't know anything. I looked him up. He did stuff... Excuse me for a second. My dear Chester, why are you biting me at this particular moment? My dog is just biting me. Hey, would you please lay down and sit down? Ow! Jesus!
I guess the answer is no.
That doesn't...
Pretty sure that means there's going to be an earthquake.
Oh. Musician,
yeah, oh Ray yeah, Ellis, yeah.
Right?
He scored
some
the music. He did
Billie Holiday
movies.
Things,
yeah,
or
yeah.
something. But he also did, some film work, some commercials.
A lot of those cartoon musicians who like in the 30s, 40s, all the way up through the 70s, were some real unsung brilliant musicians. All the way from Hoyt Curtin was doing Hanna-Barbera, but you go back to Carl Stalling for the Warner Brothers cartoon. That the music, if you listen to some of the scoring. It's just incredible. I have collections of just some of the background music from Warner Brothers cartoons.
Right.
It was amazing. And then you've got Winston Sharples over at Paramount. And, it just goes on. And the music itself is beautiful.
And then there's Ray Scott, who... excuse me. Hey. do you know Ray Scott?
I don't. Is it funny?
You might like him. He is a guy... I don't know if his music sounds like it was made for cartoons.
Really?
In the 30s, 40s. And it's a bunch of... goofy rhythms and interesting.
Oh, I'm gonna have to look them up.
Tin Pan things coming in. If you like the 40s, cartoon music, you would enjoy
Ray Scott. All right,
and
I'm looking
his music
up.
Has been commercially re-released in the past 10 years.
Fantastic.
No,
nice.
You'll like Ray Scott. If not, I'll send you a thing. You brought me a book.
I sure did.
The Adventures of Mrs. Jesus.
Oh, it's a lovely, thoughtful book.
I brought a cartoon. No, I brought one panel for this because it was really funny, but. What I wrote down a tagline. I don't know if it's your tagline. Behind every successful man is a resentful woman.
I don't know if it was mine.
Did you write that?
No, I don't think I did. I think you did. It was not mine.
I mean, I can't be the first person that wrote that.
Well,
hey, would you please chill out? What are you doing? Where did you get the idea for this book?
Well, no, I'll tell you. I was going through a bad time in my life. I was working at Modern Family, which was a good thing, but personally, I was going through a bad time. And I drew the first cartoon on a script, the back of a script. I drew a picture of Jesus on the cross. Forgive me, people out there.
Yeah, they're almost all Jesus on the cross.
Right? They almost are, yeah. And Jesus on the cross, and there's a woman standing at the base of the cross, and she's saying, "Are you even going to ask me about my day?" And I wrote The Adventures of Mrs. Jesus on it, and I passed it around. We all kind of laughed at it. And then that night I was home. I'd just been separated from my wife, and I was in this little apartment, this miserable little place, and taking antidepressants and anti-anxiety pills and just waiting for them to kick in. And I thought, well,
wives do that. You know what I mean?
I guess so. Yeah. I guess so. And so I thought, well, I'll put that picture on Facebook, but I didn't feel like drawing it again. So I went online, and I sort of cut out, with my limited knowledge of how the internet works, I cut out an image from a couple of Renaissance paintings. And I recreated the image and put a word balloon in there and put it up. And some people loved it and some people hated it. But then the next night I did another one with these characters and then another one and another one. And then themes started to come and I added characters and storylines. And after I did about 100 of them, HarperCollins said, if you do 50 more that haven't been on on the internet, we'll make it into a book. So I sort of closed out the series. There's an overarching sort of theme and narrative throughout this book, and it ends in what I hope is a surprising and hopefully touching place.
Well, this is one of my favorites, the one I pulled out here. The woman, Mrs. Jesus, how about if I read her and you can read him?
Okay, I have to see which one this is.
Jesus is on the cross, and there's his wife presumably standing at the bottom, and she says, "So I noticed our footprints in the sand today. There were two sets of prints, but whenever things got hard for us, there was only one set. Why did you leave?"
And he says, "I didn't. That's when you wouldn't get off my back." See, it's that kind of humor that permeates the pages of The Adventures of Mrs. Jesus, which you can get on Amazon. It's very cheap. It was terribly offensive, terribly offensive.
Some people.
You know what? Here's the
Not
thing.
Everybody.
Oh, here's what happened. And by the way, much more fun than the actual book, and I'll recommend this to anyone out there, is go to Amazon. Don't even have to order the book, but read the reviews of this book, The Adventures of Mrs. Jesus by Dan O'Shannon. And there are some people who just think it's wonderful, and then some people just rail at me, and they call me names, and they tell me how I'm going to burn in hell and beg Jesus for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And what they don't seem to see – now, look, I will cop to the idea that you know, if I'm using Jesus in a cartoon and Jesus is on the cross, that already I'm in sacrilegious territory.
Yeah, blasphemous.
But he's actually never really the butt of the jokes. It's the people around him, including his wife, mm-hmm. who – she's a character who at this time in the story is so self-obsessed that she is not noticing the suffering of someone in front of her, which is like we all are. And she's somebody who's jealous of the attention that he's getting.
Yeah.
I never make fun of the miracle of the crucifixion right. or the reason he's doing it or the religion behind it. So people say, you know, I'm Christian bashing. But I'm actually not. I'm human bashing. It's really I Love Lucy taken to its biggest extreme. She wants to be in the show.
Yeah.
And she constantly talks about how she wants to be part of the Holy Trinity and why is there a Holy Spirit? He doesn't do anything when I could do so much more. So it really is about humans and human pettiness in the face of this divine miracle. But people see the cover of it and they absolutely judge the book. And I get slammed like you would not believe.
Oh, I would believe it.
So
I'm going to read the reviews.
Yeah, the reviews are great.
Well, you added something that makes perfect sense, but I didn't make the connection. This is what Lucy does, right?
Yeah.
This is a major theme of the Lucy show, that she wants to be in the show. She needs the attention. You know, why don't people pay attention to her? And this is what Mrs. Jesus.
Yeah, she's a little, I suppose, a little more petty, at least at the beginning of the book, a little more petty than Lucy was. But it all comes from a place of feeling like my husband's getting all the attention and I'm not. And like I say, it goes somewhere, so it sort of ends on a nicer note. But read the book and see.
Yeah,
read the reviews.
Like this one. Jesus, again, is on the cross, and I don't want to say Mary because
– No, yeah, because Mary's his mother.
This is
his mythical wife.
We don't know
I never actually named her, actually.
Well, it could be Mary Magdalene, but
I actually mentioned Mary Magdalene, but it's not her. Mary Magdalene is a woman that she's kind of suspicious about their relationship.
Exactly. So anyway, he's up on the cross. His wife is down below, and she has a slingshot in her hand.
Yes,
that's the great part. And she says, "I took a break and got us some snacks. Do you still like milk duds?"
Right. That's the only way she's going to get him up there.
So you could have left the slingshot off.
And then she's just being nice.
And then it could have just been nice. But adding the slingshot now.
Now, yeah. See, there's a lot of them where she actually, in her own way, thinks she's doing a nice thing. There's one where the rain is pouring down. She's holding an umbrella. And he's holding an umbrella in his hand. But because it's nailed to the cross, it's off to the side. So it's only keeping the end of his arm dry. And she's saying, I can't remember what the actual line is. It's like, would he kill you to say thank you or something like that.
Yeah.
So she thinks she's doing something good for him, but every time she's doing something good for him, it ends up making things somehow worse for him.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm still checking out the slingshot here because I want to ask you about your other book, and then this leads into it immediately, which is when you put the slingshot in her hand.
The reader has to
do some work.
Yes, exactly.
The reader has to do some work to figure out why, what's happening, and that's the funniest part.
Right. It's like without the slingshot, she's just being nice to him. With the slingshot, it's like she's doing nice, but she's actually going to use a slingshot to basically fire milk duds into his mouth.
Right. That's the funniest. That's what makes it.
So, the reader does have to do that math.
Yeah, well, thank you. I got a lot of stuff to ask you here. Here's something else. You're from Cleveland. I just wanted to take a moment to, let's say something nice about Cleveland.
I love Cleveland.
Nobody ever says anything good about Cleveland.
Oh, well, you know, Cleveland's great. It's got everything. I have a place there, actually, and I go back whenever I can. And what I really like about it is that, nobody there is in show business,
right.
Which is really nice. Here in Los Angeles, it seems like everybody is. And there's actual real people there, which is nice. And I like the change of seasons and fireflies and all the stuff that Cleveland has that I think I took for granted growing up before I came out here 30 some odd years ago. But I go back when I can. The people are real, and they're all very nice when you sort of meet them individually.
Yeah.
And I couldn't recommend it enough. It's got and downtown is sort of bringing itself back to life, and it's got world-class restaurants and places to go, and we have teams that seem to win games every now and again.
If you pretend
the Browns don't exist, you're all set.
Yeah.
But I can't recommend it highly enough. I love Cleveland.
Well, I like Cleveland. I try to say good things because nobody says anything good.
Yeah.
I also think it's kind of politically and culturally the best part of Ohio.
I believe that is true. Although it's like
Austin,
a little frightening
Texas
over
of Ohio.
There. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Comparatively speaking, the Austin, Texas of Ohio.
Because I have a place there, I was able to vote in the last election in Ohio. Anyway.
So, my Cleveland story is that I was there one time working, and I was in a bar in the flats and talking to people, and I said something. It was in the 90s, and I said, yeah, what about in the 70s when you had a fire, the river,
caught on fire.
So polluted that it caught on fire. And this guy slams his hand down on the bar, and he says, Jesus Christ, your river catches on fire one time, and that's all anybody wants to talk about.
The joke's on him. It happened a few times.
I thought that was really
so
good.
Funny.
That helped me. Now, here's something just confusing. When I Google you, Dan O'Shannon, first two things are net worth and married.
Destroyed the first one.
You don't seem like a super player. You seem like a nerdy guy with glasses. But, the women of Hollywood evidently have the knives. They're out.
Really?
I don't know.
Get a little piece of this,
Yeah. Like, is he married and what's he worth? You got any comment about how do you do this? Can I do that?
No, it costs a fortune. You don't want to do it. Net worth. Did you look it up? Was it a big number?
No, I didn't care about your net worth.
I'm curious.
There can't be
much of it left because of the marriage situation. I have two ex-wives, and one is a very lovely person, and the other one is not so much. But... yeah, that wrung me dry, but so I'm very careful.
Yeah, so you don't Google yourself. You didn't know that these are the first two things that came up.
I truly didn't. I just assumed it would be like IMDb page or whatever.
That's why I was surprised.
Oh, well, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, so you should Google yourself more frequently.
Oh, great.
Can we talk about this book?
Yes, please, let's.
This is a book that you published a few years ago called What Are You Laughing At? The Comprehensive Guide to the Comedic Event.
Oh, that sounds so smart.
It does sound so smart. And before we get into how smart and all that kind of stuff it is, I like that you've created a kind of mathematical system to do stuff that is not generally math, and that's great. Here's my one quick question.
Yes, yes, sir.
In this illustration,
that diagram. No,
the
they
front,
just someone just made it. I didn't make
excuse
it.
Excuse me. I understand that, but I thought you would at least be proofreading it.
No, it doesn't make any sense. It's all made up. That
well,
that
but
bit.
Most, hey, excuse me. Okay, most of it makes some sense, except. Uh-huh. This arrow, like the angle of slippage,
I have no
makes
idea what
it
means.
Seem like his foot is going to go backwards and he's going to fall forward.
It does. Yeah. Why would it be like that? Exactly right.
And I think
someone
the arrow should just
job.
Be going on, right? Because when people slip on a banana, don't we generally believe that they slip backwards?
We obey the laws of physics.
Yeah.
We can't help it.
Yeah.
You know what? This is a stupid book.
That's
it's
just possible.
We don't need that. We'll talk about something
it's
else.
It's possible to slip the other way, but all right. Had you noticed? You hadn't noticed that.
I didn't notice
the
that.
The cover of your book has a,
no, I haven't,
a physics problem.
I haven't read it. I wonder what the insides are like.
You haven't read it?
I'm sure it's good.
No.
I've looked through
it.
I actually haven't. I haven't opened it in ages. And
you read
I,
it.
I spent years on it. So.
I'm so sorry. I have no idea why you're having a hard time. Yeah, I just don't get it. I really don't. He never does this. We're at home. He's totally
strange.
Totally calm.
I will say for the people listening that the dog is not actually barking at me. It's not like he senses that I'm the devil or anything.
He wants something. What is it? How can I help you?
See.
Here, come and sit in my lap.
While he does that, I'll tell you about Cleveland, Ohio. It's a beautiful place in what we call the Midwest.
So this book is about the mechanics of comedy.
It's trying to look for a definition of it. You know, I know people, some people in academia who were doing some tests on senses of humor, and measuring why, you know, trying to quantify senses of humor to some extent and differentiate between this and that. And there are differences in people's senses of humor, but all of them relied on various incomplete and really ill-informed ideas of what comedy is. They didn't have like a set idea of what comedy was to work from. So by not having a fixed point anywhere, everything was absolutely up for grabs and pointless. And so I started looking into it just a little bit. I didn't read a whole lot of comedy theory. I read just enough to realize that there is not one universal kind of model for how comedy works. And there are pieces that feel right and then pieces that make no sense at all. And I was putting it down, as I tend to do. And I thought one day, well, instead of just putting it down, what would I – if I know so much, how would I define comedy? And I sat down and I started to sort of draw it out. I'm very visual, so I started to draw it out a little bit. And that became the germ for what became this book, which 8 years later I finished. And it was tough to go through it. But I feel like, you know, with a couple of tweaks here and there, I think I got it, actually.
Is there a place where you say, here's the secret?
No, but in a way there is.
It's
the secret is changing the question.
Yes.
The question is, what is funny versus what is not funny? Why is X always funny and why is X always not funny? And I think that question has to be changed. There is nothing that is always funny or never funny, ever. And there is no joke, and I point this out, I'm pretty, you know, I get very worked up about it. There is no golden ticket. There is no magic key. There is no joke that always works. And to keep trying to understand comedy by analyzing jokes is not going to help, because jokes are also a tiny part of what comedy is. Like if you you feed your baby a pickle and the baby makes a face and you laugh your head off, where was the actual joke? So humor is so much bigger than jokes. So by analyzing jokes, by testing jokes, by seeing what jokes people like the most, you will not know anything about comedy. Also, there are too many questions when you test jokes. Do you send them out and people read them? Are they performed? Is the performance good or bad? Are you – like when they test sitcoms, they have a bunch of strangers in a room who have never watched TV together and they've got their hands on a dial and they have to assess how they feel about every single moment. That's not how they experience the TV shows. So testing is absolutely 100% useless. And I will say that. I'll go on the record and say that. But to get back to that what is the question? So then if you take out the why is something always funny or what is funny, because you're not going to find the thing that is funny. So the question becomes, what are the variables that come into play that can make someone experience information as funny versus not funny? And this is an examination of those variables that come into play. Because there are times, you know, you can have a fantastic joke, beautifully told. In one universe, it's told by someone you hate. In the other universe, it's told by someone you love. Or in one universe, it's told at a time when you were extremely tired, and the other is at a time when you were totally relaxed. Different reactions all around to the exact same joke. So stop analyzing the jokes. Understand the experience and understand the variables that come into play. You know, and once you start doing that, things start to make a little more sense. If you want to see a sort of brief overview of this whole book, like on a lecture, if you go to oshannonland.com, you'll see a click to a lecture I did on it. It sort of gives an overview, but there's still so much more in the book than in that.
You know, for thousands of years, people have been trying to figure out, explain comedy.
Well, yeah, the problem.
The physiological effect, the social effect, the psychological effect, why we laugh in the first place, Freud. I mean, everybody.
Yeah, but you know, the problem with that is that every one of those people that have taken the time in their careers to identify comedy, and many of them, by the way, get a lot of stuff right.
Yeah.
But people, you know, you go through, you know, from Aristotle, Hobbes, Schopenhauer, Freud, et cetera, et cetera.
That's what I'm saying.
But comedy was not their field.
Right.
In all these cases, they're philosophers, they're writers, they take on a bunch of things, psychologists, and then basically one day they go, well, if I know this much, I'm gonna take a break now and I'm gonna define comedy. And they don't sit with it, they don't live it.
Right.
It's not their lives, it's not what they do. They are not known for being hilarious. They basically take their expertise and they turn it toward that, and they examine their part of the field. Freud, by going to relief, which by the way is a big part of comedy, by going to that, it's the Freud view. That's the window he's going to look in. You know, superiority, incongruity, etc. People look through their windows. And I, the advantage, I believe, that I have is that this has been my life since I was basically a kid. And then I started doing stand-up when I was 18, and I studied. And I was analytical, and I with all these TV shows. So every TV show I had where I have a live studio audience and run through after run through and every version of every joke – and figuring out how and why people laugh. I mean, I lived it in a way these people never will. You know, there's an academic who wrote a book recently, and it's he's got a good idea, but it's really like an acorn that he's showing people and telling them it's an oak. He's got this one piece, you know, and it's not really different from what I have. There's this one sort of piece, except that he labels it differently. And he and I were talking, and he said to me, "I find it interesting that we both study comedy, and I study it from the inside, and you study it from the outside." And I thought, how did I get outside of comedy? I can't be more inside of it.
You can't be more.
You know,
inside
it's a very interesting academic ego that goes with this. But yeah, so I'm very lucky in that. I'm also lucky. The other thing that made this book possible is that I was not born funny. You know, I was not a naturally funny kid. And when I was 8 years old, there's an incident, I describe it in the introduction, where I literally decided, starting tomorrow, I'm going to be funny. You know. And I had no idea how to start, so I started the way anyone does, which is imitate that which they find funny, and I was bad at it.
I did
Jerry Lewis, which at the time was just rerun. All his movies were on TV all the time, so I was constantly doing that and being terribly unfunny. But I was like fascinated by it. I would watch the sitcoms and read the funnies and the Mad magazines. And I got older. I started doing essays or reading the essays and reading about humor whenever I could. And soaking it in and soaking and trying and hit and miss and trial and error and learning that this particular kind of humor would work on this person but not on that person. It would work in this situation but not in that situation. I began to appreciate context. And then when I started doing stand-up, it became a huge lesson in how to make people laugh, you know, and that became the laboratory. And then all the TV shows became the laboratory. And I'll tell you a story of the first kind of real good insight I had when I was doing stand-up, if you don't mind.
It's kind of why you're here.
Okay, great. Yeah. Fantastic. when I first started doing it, I was about 18, and I was about to drop out of college. And I had grouped together a bunch of topics, jokes and a bunch of topics, like going to school, girlfriend, sex, politics, family, whatever. I grouped them into topics and a couple of segues. And I went on stage, open mic night, and I did the jokes. And I did all right. In fact, I did pretty well. My first couple of weeks, I did really well. And then I bombed, which I was not prepared for. I thought, oh, I got this, you know. And then I bombed. And then I was very hit and miss. Some nights I would kill. Some nights I would not do so well. And I would always go back and change jokes and reorder them and do new versions of the jokes. All my friends were doing the same thing because we were all starting stand-up at the same time. And then one day I had this revelation. I was cutting the grass in my parents' yard. And suddenly it like hit me like a lightning bolt. I was thinking about how come it works. Sometimes it doesn't. It's like kind of getting the audience there. It's like trying to push water somewhere. I couldn't seem to get them there. And then I thought, well, why don't, instead of like examining the act for the millionth time, why not look at it from their point of view? What is the audience experience? And I thought, well, you know, they hear the sound of my name, Dan O'Shannon, and then I go bouncing up the stairs and I bop over to the mic, which is in the middle of the stage. And at the time, as I say, I was like 18, maybe 19 by then, and I looked very young. I looked like I was 12. So they are already deciding who I am. Now, if I start talking about sex or politics, I have no credibility. It looks like it's made up. It doesn't jibe with what they think of me. Now, a strong comedian with a strong point of view and someone with the chops could bend the audience to whatever he wanted, but I was not like that. So I thought, well, why fight them? Why fight their impression of me? Why not use it? So I immediately dropped everything that was that I called worldly out of my act. I wasn't supposed to be worldly. I didn't look it.
Right.
And the next time I went on stage, I wore a sweatshirt that was a couple sizes too big, and I amped up my nervous energy and became essentially a character. And when I did my jokes, the jokes that did okay did great, and the jokes that had done great got applause. And that's the night I joined my act. That's the night I realized that an act was an experience, that comedy was an experience. It's not a bunch of material and words written on a piece of paper. See, before that, I used to just think that all comedy was the jokes and the structure and the this and that, and I would go, and the idea was that I would say them to an audience, almost like putting them up on a shelf, and they would all just laugh at those things independently of me. But when I joined my act and understood that there was an experience being created by the audience and myself, suddenly every joke told them a little more about this guy on the stage who they were developing some sort of feelings about or opinions about, and that person then infused every joke. So I joined the act, and that was my first big sort of insight that kind of like propelled me to a next level. And then many of those followed through the years.
Well, a lot of the book is about this part, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, well, there's a whole section
asking,
on
the, just checking, like, who are the people who are watching? What's the environment? All
oh,
the
yeah,
stuff
all the, all
that
the,
goes
all
into,
the elements of context. Yeah. And yeah, yeah. And there's all kinds of stuff, like, you know, enhancers and inhibitors, you know, like attaching the jokes to different feelings to right. use them as rocket fuel and stuff
now,
like that.
Now, I don't feel like in this book I learned how to write a joke mm-hmm. or how to be funny.
Right. It's, yeah, it's, and I say at the top of the book, because, sure. you know, it's not a how-to.
But
yeah.
some books yeah. are like that. Here's yeah. how to be funnier. Here's how yeah. to write jokes. Here's how to make millions.
Yeah, with no, yeah. And I'm very clear at the top of this, because a couple of people have gotten it hoping it was that, and right. I'm very clear that it's not. There's a couple things. There is a section on joke structure to some extent. There's a couple of sections on what cognitive process and call it an incongruity, and that goes into joke structure. And there's an example I call it, I think, container corruption, where you take a phrase and then if you just tweak one little thing, you have wordplay or a joke or whatever.
Right.
And I talk – one of the things – I mean, there are things here like that you can – sort of go through and get a few things out of it. Like that one, I had an experience the other day. I'd written a line on Cheers years ago, and obviously, and there's a character named Cliff, and he's the mailman who's a know-it-all, and he lives with his mom, and they have a very close relationship. And he's at the bar, and somebody asks him what a Freudian slip is, and he says, that's when you say one thing, but you're thinking about a mother. Okay? And that's the line I wrote. And it worked great for him, because he lives with his mom, and it's a Freudian slip
right.
when he's talking about doing a Freudian slip. But I've seen that line since someone posted a picture like a couple weeks ago of a coffee mug with that line on it. But people who have appropriated it changed the line to a Freudian slip is when you say something, but you're thinking about your mother. Now, by changing a mother to your mother, they're actually hurting the joke because it has to sound as close to the source material, another, a
right.
mother,
yeah.
not another versus your mother. They actually downgrade the joke a little by
right.
trying to fix it. They kind
right.
of hurt it. And that's something that's a basic understanding of how you want the thing you're changing to be as close to the source material as you can.
Well, that's part of what makes it
yeah.
funny or not funny.
Yeah.
So I feel like I didn't necessarily get more funny, but mm-hmm. I got smarter
well, that's good.
About the
yeah.
jokes that I write,
yeah.
the jokes that I hear. And as I was reading the book, it reminded me of all kinds of jokes of my life, favorite jokes mm. and things that I – and I said, oh, that's where – it goes in this bucket, or this joke
oh.
goes in that bucket, or that's why this one works, and it's a different thing
oh,
than the other. So, I mean, yeah, I felt like I got smarter about stuff.
Hopefully. I'll give them something to think about. When I lecture on this, I always say my goal is that at the end of it you hear laughter differently,
yeah.
including your own.
Yeah.
You know, I'll say one more quick story, hopefully, and move on. But I talk about, you know, as a kid being fascinated by what was making people laugh. And I use an example of a laugh that took me 15 years to figure out.
Right.
It's from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And in the episode, Mary goes on a date with her boss, Lou Grant. Now, they've been on the show for about 6 years by that point. And they decide, well, we're friends. Let's see if a date can work. And that how are we doing for time?
You're good.
Okay.
Just, yeah.
All right.
I'll be in charge of whatever.
Okay. And they go on this date, and it's very awkward, and it culminates with them trying to go in for this kiss. And as they're going into the kiss, they realize how silly they're being, and they start to laugh. And the studio audience laughs. It's a loud laugh, but then it kind of tapers suddenly. It doesn't just sort of like you know, go on and unravel the way laughs generally do from a large studio audience. And as a 15-year-old, I remember thinking there was something unsatisfying about that, or it didn't quite feel right. I couldn't put my finger on what it was. And 15 years later, I was writing for Cheers, and I wrote an episode for – a joke for Norm where he starts talking about how he's going to get off his ass and get a job and tell his wife he loves her and stop drinking beer. But he's only been saying it in jest, and he can't get through with the idea. It's so silly to him that he can't even say it without laughing. So he makes himself laugh in the middle of the sentence. And as he's doing it, I hear this loud laugh from the studio audience and then this sudden taper. And I then understood about what was happening on the Mary Tyler Moore Show 15 years ago. What was happening – and we would never predict this at home, but the studio audience thought they were seeing a blooper each time, because in the middle of doing something, a character starts laughing, and they have seen bloopers on TV, and that often signals that the actors can't remember their next line. So there's this loud shriek of laughter. Oh my God, the actors are messing up, but the scene keeps going. So suddenly they get back quiet again to get back in the scene.
To get back in the world.
So it's very confusing, because it's a laugh in the right place, but for the wrong reason. And I was talking to the guy who wrote the Mary Tyler Moore episode about that, and he thought that was a fascinating idea, but that they were getting – so you get the right sound but for the wrong reason, which is why context is so important. A studio audience could make that mistake, right, but an audience at home would never make that mistake.
People at home are not going to make that mistake.
They don't believe a blooper could happen in the middle of a show.
Before we run on, I just got to say, because it makes me look intelligent for my audience.
Oh, please.
No, I'm teasing. For me, what was most useful about this book is this notion about the work, the cognitive work that we want to do as the receiver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that humor is a some assembly required activity. And not all the laugh is in the assembly, but for me, you know, we have to do some work, like the thing with the slingshot and the milk duds.
Sure.
And I like what you say, that a lot of – some theories of comedy say you have to release the tension.
Mm-hmm.
And Freud – but I agree with you where you're saying you have to maintain it and sustain it. That's like totally opposite of prevailing.
That tends to me to be more about incongruity, because there's a theory that incongruity is being resolved at the end of the joke. And I believe incongruity – the whole point of it is to create incongruity, which then makes us laugh. I think there is definitely a lot of humor that involves assembly.
Right.
But an example of that for the people listening is the old joke of your mom is so fat when she wears white they show movies on her. And what happens is the listener then has to realize that the mother is as big as a movie screen. And then you have your incongruous image and you can hopefully laugh or roll your eyes or whatever you're doing at home. But it would be so much easier and exactly the same thing, you know, conceptually to say your mother's as large as a movie screen. But that's not as funny because you didn't have to do any work. But if I give you the pieces and then you put together the pieces and then the pieces create this thing that makes you go, no, well, then it's funny because you had to do it to yourself in a way.
Anyway, I could talk about that for a long, long time. Here are some other things I got from your book that made me laugh. You reminded me that the Flintstones, a cartoon, had a laugh track.
Yeah, isn't that great?
A fake studio audience.
Yeah. They were just used to seeing that on sitcoms, and this was a sitcom. It was just animated, so throw in a studio audience. It was hilarious.
I mean, it's obviously the Honeymooners and built, so I think even more than it's a sitcom. It's kind of like the
Andy Andy Griffith, you know, whatever. There wasn't a sitcom on back then that didn't have some sort of laugh track.
Right. Yeah, Andy Griffith does too.
There's shots where they're clearly outside or in the woods, and Barney will do something stupid. And there's a studio audience, and you know, if you think about that, did they set up bleachers in the woods? You know, so that people could laugh. No, it's all recorded laughter.
And what do you think that kind of thing helps the audience know when to laugh or where to laugh, or what does that do? Does that help?
I don't know if it helps them as far as when to – I guess it could if people are really dopey. But I think it's it comes from radio, I think, really. And there were a lot of shows that were done in front of studio audiences. And then I remember reading the story, and I can't remember if it was the Fred Allen Show or whatever. It's a long time ago, where they tried doing a episode of this radio show without the studio audience coming in, and it bombed. And that didn't mean the comedy was bad. It felt like it bombed because we were used to hearing that sound of people laughing. And one thing about comedy, I talk about this in the book, is that it is it can be as a shared experience, a communal experience. It amplifies the laugh. It amplifies the feeling that comes along with it. It's one of the reasons on a single camera sitcom, the kind of sitcom without a studio audience, you can do mild jokes. That is, jokes that make these people at home smile or just appreciate without laughing out loud. On a multicam, which has a studio audience, every one of your jokes has to be big enough to make the studio audience laugh. Because if you do a mild joke that just elicits a smile from the studio audience, and then you're watching it on TV, it looks like the joke bombed because you recognize that something funny is being said, but you're hearing people not laugh.
There's no response. Yeah.
So it feels to you like it bombed. You're not able to appreciate because you hear the absence of the laugh. Right.
Now, is the laugh track dead? Does anybody use it anymore?
I think sometimes people will sweeten for technical reasons. One thing that happens.
I feel like some shows I watch, I feel like, okay, that's not.
Well, here's the thing.
That's not a real
laugh. There are two things that happen. Often that certain create that impression. One is that the volume, the audience is mic'd, and so if they turn up that volume really high, then it seems unreal. I worked on a show 2 years ago where they just kept cranking the laugh track, and you'd watch it and you go, oh my God, stop it. These jokes are not this funny.
And people are kind of chortling.
But gigantically huge, right? But another thing is that you know, you're watching a sitcom at home by yourself, you're less likely to laugh out loud at all the same jokes as the studio audience. And part of the reason is the studio audience is their part of laughter is communication. You know, laughter will slide into applause very easily. So when they're laughing at the live actors, they're saying, you know, gosh, you know, we love your work, you know, Matt LeBlanc, whoever they happen to be watching. So part of the laughter is acknowledging to them that they love the work, but it's also sharing it, that communal thing, with other studio audience members, all of whom are excited to be in Hollywood. They have a warm-up guy in between every scene throwing sugar at them. And so all this stuff is happening to them that's not happening to the people at home. And that's why I call it the comedic event, because you at home are watching the exact same comedic material as the people in the studio audience, and you're having an entirely different event. Yeah. And that is why people will laugh differently in one event as opposed to another, and not about the material, it's about the event.
Right. Those guys that do the warm-up, that's the hardest work in show business.
The good ones are just, they never stop amazing me.
And they're there for 3 hours?
Sometimes more.
More, and they just keep going.
Yeah.
The first time I saw one of those people, I said, that is a pro.
They definitely earn their money.
That's a really amazing thing. Okay, I got to ask this question.
Sure.
Maybe you can help me. My grandfather loved old, corny, stupid jokes, as many grandfathers do. And he was a guy that always wanted a son. He had four daughters. So when I was born, I was the first guy, and he went crazy. He was a carpenter. And literally, by the time I was 3 years old, I knew the names of all the tools in his toolbox.
Wow.
And a bunch of jokes. He would start them, and I would finish them, that kind of thing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He died when I was six.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But my whole life, I've been hearing these jokes over and over from his daughters, and, you know, this is my canon now or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was watching BoJack Horseman
about
a year ago, and there's an episode, Lisa Kudrow's character who plays the owl who's been in a coma for 30 years, and then she comes up, and so she tells BoJack this joke. And all the details were changed, but I recognize that this is a joke that my grandfather told me and that I've told and is, to me, a famous joke in my world. And I want to know who wrote that joke. Who put that joke in BoJack Horseman and where the hell they got it.
How interesting. What's the joke?
Well, I can't. It's a long joke,
right,
and it's drawn out. And
well, you know what? Then, you know, email the writer.
Yeah.
You know?
I got it.
They'll know.
I got it. Yeah, I just need to find.
How interesting. Yeah, yeah.
I need to find that. I had that experience one other time. He told this joke. He's partially sang it. This one I can tell you. And he would start to sing and say, they were lost way out in the woods, and it was dark and lonely, and all they had between the three was one slice of bologna. So they said, hey, what are we going to do? We only have one slice of bologna. We're three guys. What happens next? And one of them has a great idea. He says, I know. Let's all go to sleep. And in the morning, we'll wake up, and who's ever had the best dream will get the slice of bologna.
All right.
So they all do that, and they wake up in the morning, and the first guy says, I dreamt that I died and went to heaven. You say, oh, that's a pretty good dream. The second guy says, well, I dreamt that I died and I went to heaven. And they say, oh, that's a pretty good dream, too. The third guy says, I dreamt that you both died and went to heaven, so I got up and ate the bologna.
Okay.
So, you know, that's his joke.
Yeah.
I never heard it. I went to clown school in Boulder, Colorado a few years ago, and one of the things was to bring a song and bring a joke and bring, you know, so said, great, my clown's going to tell this joke. And I told this joke, or my clown told this joke, and one of my colleagues came up to me and said, where did you get that joke? I can't believe you know that joke. We used to listen to that.
The funniest
it was
thing.
In an Orson Bean LP
oh, for heaven's
from
sake.
The early 60s, and that's where she heard it.
Oh, wow.
So of course I went online, I found the album, I brought it home, I played it, and it was super interesting because Orson Bean sings the whole thing. He does sing it along to Pop Goes the Weasel. Mm-hmm. But the guy who gets the baloney, he made him a Jew.
Oh, great.
And so it's like this whole joke about the kind of conniving Hebrew.
Oh, brilliant.
And there's a woman in the front who's laughing really loudly.
Oh, you know, dear.
It was totally different.
Oh,
but it was a little, you talk about being a comedy detective, it was a little bit of detective work into my own history.
Yeah, no, so, I love it. It's sometimes you'll hear a joke and then it's like you'll like the old Warner Brothers cartoons jokes where they're, you know, sometimes they'll say these things in a couple of cartoons and you don't know what it is, and then you'll be reading something about World War II and there was some advertisement for something and oh, that's what they were making fun of, and suddenly it makes sense. Oh, they're doing Joe Penner, you know, they're doing an impression of Joe Penner on the radio. Well, who the hell now knows who Joe Penner is, or Want to Buy a Duck or whatever the heck he was saying, you know. I kind of like solving those things, like, oh, that's what that joke is from. You know, I wrote a joke that every now and again you write a joke that sort of like breaks out of the TV show and becomes a thing people say, you know. I did a line for, again, it was back at Cheers, a line for Cliff where he says this long thing and everyone looks at him and he looks and he says, did I say that out loud? And what happened was 2 years later or a year later, two of our writers had gone on different shows and they used that line to get out of a dramatic, you know, thing. And then it started popping up on TV shows everywhere. And then I started seeing it in real life. And so, like, people I grew up with, I'd be talking to them, and they'd say something, and they'd say, did I say that out loud? And say, you know, I wrote that. And that's
you
the funniest
did.
Thing.
All right.
So, like, that's why I know. But, you know, everything that you hear that's a joke that gets around, like when someone says, said no one ever, or, right. or you know, I know you are, but what am I? Somebody said it first, you know. And
somebody did.
Yeah.
Speaking of people that said it first, you've worked in your career with Bob Newhart.
Yeah.
Right? On the last Bob Newhart show.
That's right, yeah. Well, on the one where he had an inn, you know, with
that was
Vermont.
The, yes, that was
well, he did a couple shows since then.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
okay.
They weren't big hits, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. I just want to check in about, he was an innovator. A lot of people, younger people, Bob Newhart, whatever, but you want to say anything about that?
I used to listen to his albums when I was a kid.
Yeah.
My mom had the albums, and I listened to them till the needle, you know,
yeah.
so the grooves wore out, you know. But he was terrific, and I worked on the show for 1 year, and I was so afraid of him. I don't think I actually talked to him until the last episode of the year. I finally introduced myself. You know, the finale with Suzanne Plachette?
Yeah.
That's mine. So I have that little piece of TV history.
Yeah. I think that was the first show where I really – you know, as a kid, I asked the question, what is that beautiful woman doing with this goofy, schlubby guy? And that was the first show that it popped
Isn't
into
that
my
funny?
Awareness. But
yeah.
every sitcom family.
Ever since then, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
it's, yeah, from Jackie Gleason.
Back. Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's always a,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, I read this. Did you see that thing that someone wrote about Friends being the end of civilization because it was all an anti-intellectual exercise that Ross is like the smart guy and they just make fun of him and beat him down until he can... be one of the group. I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was probably very correct, except that I think the author should have done a little more into that because you can find antecedents to that. I mean, when Frasier was in the bar at Cheers, you know, he was always made fun of for being intellectual, and he kept staying because he wanted to be part of the group even as he looked down on them, and they beat him down into being one of the regulars, you know.
So, and who's the woman that he seems, not Liesl?
Lilith.
Lilith, yeah she's the same.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
nobody likes her. She's cold.
Yeah.
And she's
so always
smart.
Make fun of the intellectuals, you know.
Yeah.
A little bit like that, even Green Acres, I think. Yeah.
Last summer I was in Ocean City, New Jersey, and the Honeymooners was on.
Oh, yeah?
And Ralph and Ed were someplace, and Ed was being irritating, and he leaves the room, and Ralph says to another guy, he says, if that guy wasn't my best friend, I would have nothing to do with him. And I said, this is it. This is the beginning of this whole genre.
Isn't that funny?
You know, is what these guys did. That relationship between these, and then the relationship that he has with his wife, you know, married with children, everything came out of that. Yeah, that's interesting. There's not enough time. I want to tell you my Noam Chomsky joke. I'm going to tell you my Marshall McLuhan joke. They might not be funny.
All right.
But every once in a while, somebody will guffaw.
Okay.
When I say, and then if I tell one, and then at the end of my set, I tell the other,
that same person
will laugh even more loudly because now I've made two jokes that are kind of like that. But we're not going to get into that. Here's a question I like to ask all my guests. You have a somewhat quirky sleeping or bedtime ritual. What is it?
Do I?
What is it?
Are we assuming that's true, or we just decided that's
true?
Well,
I'm just fishing.
No, I don't.
Some people have something to say when I say that.
No, I got nothing. I guess I feel tired and I go to sleep. I mean, maybe I'm crazy.
I think
in LA, something horribly wrong with me now.
No, just in LA you're in.
No, I got
most of the country, that's what happens.
No.
People are tired, they go to sleep.
Yeah, I'm tired, I go to sleep. Sometimes I'll wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning and I'm up for an hour or two and then I conk back out, but not so much to
that
make a thing
qualify.
Of it. Yeah, no, I got nothing.
No, the people that have something when I say that, they say, how did you know?
Oh, no, I'm a disappointment then.
No, that's all right. Not every question has to work.
I try some more of these. I can't wait to...
what else I got for you? Oh, here's another one. As a child, you had an imaginary friend.
You know, the Emo Phillips had a line about when he was a child, he was someone else's imaginary friend, which I always loved. I don't... You know, I think in a weird way, I think I was my own... I think I had an imaginary audience. That's what it was. I think I had an imaginary audience in my head. They were with me, even when no one else was.
So the rest of that question is... your imaginary friend also had an imaginary friend. Where are they now?
Oh, well, I'm right here.
So if your imaginary friend was your audience, then you were them, then you're here.
I think I probably still write for that imaginary audience.
It's a little circular kind of thing.
Yeah.
Here's another thing. I had some other stuff here that, where the hell did
I go?
Oh, no. At a certain moment, I instead of a New Year's resolution, I sent a note. It was snail mail days to friends and family, telling them that it's always okay to hit me in the face with a pie or squirt seltzer. And I thought this would be useful because usually a pie is thrown with some malice and is received, not with joy. And if I removed that so that people could, I would receive it with love and joy because I'm giving you permission and it's something you want to do and you're usually forbidden and you could just do it, then it could be an exchange full of generosity and love, and that would be awesome. So over the past 20 years, I've been hit with pies like 50 times.
Now, may I ask you a question? I'm sorry not to insert you.
No, that's
all right. Was it painful? I mean, because back when they were doing it in the days, the custard pie, those were all like whipped cream and custard and this soft, spongy bottom. But a real pie in the face would be – does it hurt?
I usually have time to take my glasses off.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Sometimes that's all the time I have.
I bet.
My question for you is if you were going to do this, you're going to give permission.
Uh-huh.
To someone to hit you in the face with a pie.
Right.
And I'm going to give you the option to choose anyone living or dead through history that you would want to throw the pie that you would now receive with all this love and gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
You got it.
Oh, gosh. You know, some names pop into my head. But, it would be like a silent film comedian, like either like Keaton, who didn't do it much, or, Chaplin didn't really do it. But somebody in the silent is, I would greedily want to be the first person to receive a pie in the face in film. I'd go back to like Keystone days, or like whoever thought, or it was like, Laurel and Hardy did it all the time, or like a Hal Roach comedian, maybe like that, Or maybe if I want to get a little more, maybe I'd be like just one of the extras in like one of those highfalutin society parties that the Three Stooges would like go to, and then it would devolve into, and it just be like one shot of me getting a pie in the face and then back to the melee. It would be perfectly fine.
I like that you want to be the first person. I want to be the first person.
Yeah, it would be such a strange claim to fame, though. How much mileage do you get out of that? Probably nothing at all, really.
But it's like a great...
Because we don't know who it was, so it's
that's what we might know if it was made into a real thing. And so who are the other... You said a bunch of people popped into your head, so you got kind of silent...
Soupy Sales popped into my head. Just people who threw pies, as a rule, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Soupy Sales was a pro.
Yes, yeah.
Is from Philadelphia, where I'm from.
Oh, of course.
And even now they have a Piasco, down the shore, Ocean City, New Jersey. Once a year, they have a whole thing where everyone who shows up, they give them all whipped cream pies, and everyone pies each other.
Funny. It's the strangest thing.
Big kind of
I have to say, I always liked Soupy Sales enormously, and I never found him funny. But I always liked him. I always wanted him to be funnier than... He was. I think I saw him do stand up live once, and he just wandered through the crowd and he did these jokes. He did this one. He said, "I can't even say it. It was so horrible." But I'm fascinated. I mean, I'll go back and watch the black and white clips of him and imagine what it must have been like for kids to be watching him at lunchtime or after school, whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have that famous story about him in the morning.
Oh, yeah, so I'm morning after TV New Year's. Show. Yeah, yeah. Find those funny papers in your parents and mail them to me. Yeah.
No, that's a kind of Ernie Kovacs TV
who is great,
style
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Very experimental.
Another Philadelphia guy, Ernie Kovacs. The last thing I was going to do, which I don't know, I somehow have misplaced it. I like to anagram things.
Oh.
Like I anagrammed your name, or I was going to anagram the title of this book, but it's too long.
That's too long, but the name is a nice number. Did you come up with anything? There's lots of N's in there.
Dan O'Shannon. I did.
Oh, is that what you came up with? Because I got bad news for you. That's actually the name.
That's what?
Dan O'Shannon.
You don't get that when you say, what are you laughing at?
No,
you anagram it, you don't get Dan O'Shannon. Whatever that piece of paper is not here.
Oh, well.
I don't know what
I'll
I
never
came
know.
Up with. It wasn't really, you know, some people get really good ones.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
Or their theater company or their production company, you know, shed some new light on who they are and they get a T-shirt made. But, yeah, I lost that. I don't have anything.
I'll never know.
Curious to
lost to history.
Oh. Yeah. I'll tell you this, though. One of my favorite answers to that pie thing was a young writer who was here, and I asked him the question, and he thought about it, and he said Aristotle.
Interesting.
And I said, can you know, tell me what that? And he said, well, we have Aristotle's writing about tragedy, and we don't really – his book on comedy has been kind of lost, and we don't really know what he had to – so he would want to have Aristotle hit him with a pie and then say, how is that for you?
Oh, great.
I thought that was good.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. So if you are interested to do this, I'm going to give you a little card at the end. You can always give the card to other people. I would recommend you only make the offer to friends and family, people that know you and love you.
Right.
And
Or take the 11th caller or whoever's listening to this. Okay, whoever's listening to this, friend me on Facebook. And if you say that you listen to this, then I will fill that out, and you can be the one that hit me in the face with a pie.
That's a great offer.
Yeah. So
that's a great offer.
Because I think you know, I tend to think of all like this kind of media, the writing we do, the broadcast we do, is it's all notes and bottles. You know, it's like even if you're doing something millions of people see, it doesn't mean millions of people will be affected or even think about it the next day. But every now and again, there's somebody that you touch and you didn't mean to or you hoped you would. You might never meet them. There's a note in a bottle. So I'm throwing this note in a bottle. If somebody out there gets that note in the bottle, then you get permission to hit me in the face with a pie.
All right. So if anyone is actually listening to the show.
Yeah, it might be. We'll find out. Well, it might be that millions of people listen, but nobody wants to hit me in the face with a pie.
Okay. And we're gonna take the 11th response.
Well, I'll take the first response
we'll
on
take
Facebook.
The first response.
So friend me on Facebook. Dan O'Shannon is my name. Dan O'Shannon, with apostrophe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Friend me on Facebook, and then when I accept your friend request, because I'm pretty easy to do that way, then just let me know that you heard this, and then you know, you will always have permission to hit me in the face with a pie. One time.
Yeah. All right. And if that person's going to do that, they should also let me know.
The
show.
Yeah, yeah. That would be nice to know that this was listened to.
Yeah, and it would be helpful to so. I have a Facebook page for this activity, which is called Pie Yourself Free. Because I've realized or figured out that in receiving all these pies, you know, in the moment when someone approaches you with a pie, like all of the animal resistance, the fight flight thing still happens in my body.
Well, yeah, it should.
And which is probably a good sign. And then I have a choice of what I'm going to do with that. That's what I really want to share with people. That there is a sublime service of receiving a pie, and it does a great thing. My friends and family that have done it, they love it. and that's really the
only reason. How interesting! I never
thought
about
it. Makes other people happy, and they get to do something that they've always wanted to do.
Great.
Yeah. All right. This last thing explains an experience I've had. I was with my kid and my soon-to-be ex-wife. And I was trying to give the kid some cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an aged Gouda, which I really liked. And he had never had it. And so I said, here, try this cheese. And he says, is it Gouda? And
I said, well, it's not bad. Huh?
I said, it's better than a Gouda. It's a Grata.
Okay.
And I started to laugh so hard. And the kid kind of laughed, but my soon-to-be ex-wife had no interest in this joke, and I just couldn't stop laughing. Mm-hmm. And the more that they said this is not funny, I just kept repeating, it's better than a Gouda, it's a Greta. And it was like 10 minutes. I finally went outside. I went to sit by the river and calm down. And somehow I kept thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it. And all of a sudden I realized, like, I realized there's another layer, like Greta, like a cheese grater. And I started laughing all over again. And I thought it was even funnier that I found another layer to the thing. They were completely not interested.
Oh, isn't that funny?
But even to this day, I think it's so funny. Maybe partly because they didn't think it was funny.
Well, it's something with, like, my daughter. When she was little, I would do this thing. We'd be in a restaurant. I'd have a soda, you know, with a straw sticking out. And I would pretend to be drinking from the cup, having forgotten there was a straw, so it would always slide up under my glasses and the straw would poke me in the eye. And I would always be doing it in the context of talking about how she has to grow up and, you know, whatever. And when she was a kid, she laughed and laughed. And as she got to be a teenager, she would just look at me seething, you know. So, yeah, do the straw thing. And so now I do it, and it's funnier. Now it's funny to me because she hates it. But it becomes aggressive. It becomes an aggressive way to actually do comedy. Which is fun. Yeah.
I'm all for irritating people, pissing them off with jokes. Yeah, that's good.
You know, it's funny, the wordplay thing. Years and years ago, when I was first starting stand-up, somebody in an interview asked me if I thought my sense of humor was wry, and I said it's more like whole wheat. When I was older, someone asked me the same question, do you think your sense of humor is wry? And I said, no, it's more like whole wit. So I managed to find that extra thing at the end, but I had to be older, you know, to sort of like, oh, you know, I can find the better way.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a very I'm going to tell you one more like that, just because I like word things. I was at my aunt and uncle's house, and their powder room, the toilet was clogged, and so I said, I'm going to put a sign, or maybe she said, we have guests coming over, can you put a sign on the door? Mm-hmm. And the sign I put said, out of odor.
Oh, okay.
And that also just cracked me up for years. Hilarious. But that's okay. We should be laughing at our own jokes. Even if no one else laughs at them, that doesn't matter. No, it really doesn't. I don't care. People think I'm not funny. Well, I might. But I don't think I do.
Well, good.
And it can be irritating.
You're more than a little evil.
I'm a little bit evil. I would like to thank my not particularly evil guest, the very funny and entertaining Dan O'Shannon.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. If you'd like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, I have them now. You can email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. Dylan Vigil is our producer and engineer. Our theme music was written and performed by Dean Mermel. You've been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio right here in Hollywood, USA. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Thank you.